From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, we'll speak with an Iraqi nuclear scientist who left Iraq after 30 years. He now lives in Canada. Then, we'll look at the Miss World Beauty Contest. It was held in Nigeria until there were clashes that led to the deaths of more than 200 people. It's now been moved to London.
I'm wondering why it is that every time something extreme happens in the Muslim world, Muslim feminists are trotted out, having to defend the world of Islam. Doesn't happen when Christian fundamentalists do crazy things in parts of the Christian West or Jewish fanatics in the West Bank. Women are not called upon to identify their feminism according to their religion, so I think it's ridiculous.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. United Nations weapons inspectors have completed their first field visit in Iraq in 4 years. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said the inspections had got off to a fairly good start and urged Baghdad to continue its cooperation. Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix told Baghdad it not only must cooperate with inspectors, but it must provide convincing proof it has no weapons of mass destruction. And this news from the Financial Times, the U.S. is set to provide Saudi Arabia with new evidence about Saudi financing of terrorist groups and will warn the kingdom that Washington is prepared to act alone against those financiers if Riyadh fails to crack down. The U.S. plan to escalate pressure on Saudi Arabia comes amid allegations that funds provided by the wife of the Saudi ambassador to Washington may have been channeled to two of the 19 men who hijacked aircraft and crashed them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. A senior U.S. official said terrorist groups were receiving tens of millions of dollars per year from Saudi Arabia. The plan and the existence of the target list was first reported yesterday by the Washington Post. Ari Fleischer, the White House spokesperson, said the plan was still in its early stages. He said the U.S. is pleased with Saudi cooperation in the war on terrorism, but, quote, even a good partner like Saudi Arabia can do more. Labor unrest is spreading across Europe. In France, tens of thousands of public sector workers went on strike. Nearly 90% of flights in and out of France were canceled. There was chaos at railway and subway stations, and much of the mail went undelivered. Up to 100,000 people took to the streets of Paris and other major cities. In Britain, thousands of school teachers walked out of classes today. The teachers' strike comes during the fifth day of a firefighter strike that's being reported as Prime Minister Tony Blair's most serious challenge since he took office 5 years ago. In Rome, over 20,000 people marched to support Fiat Auto metal workers. An aide to Prime Minister Jean Chrétien of Canada, who called President Bush a moron, resigned yesterday, saying that the controversy generated by the comment has made her position untenable. During a private conversation at the NATO meeting in Prague, Chrétien's Minister of Communications made the comment about George Bush. Françoise Ducrot was considered one of the most influential players in Ottawa, and Chrétien initially refused to accept her resignation. But news organizations and opposition politicians continued to apply intense pressure, and Ducrot resigned. Canadian news outlets report White House officials privately referred to Prime Minister Chrétien as dynamite. Short for dinosaur. Several weeks ago, the German government forced out Justice Minister Erta Daubler-Gmelin after she told a small group of labor union members that President Bush is using the Iraq issue to divert attention from domestic problems like the economy and corporate scandals. She said that's a popular method. Even Hitler did that. Meanwhile, the London Guardian is reporting British broadcasting regulators are refusing to allow the broadcast of an advertisement for the acclaimed animation show 2DTV. The regulators say the ad is offensive to President Bush's intelligence, and the award-winning satirists have to ask Bush's permission. The cartoon commercial portrays President Bush opening a copy of the video. He exclaims, "My favorite, just pop it in the video player." But he puts the video in a toaster, and the tape burns to a crisp. In South Korea, protests are continuing against the U.S. military after a military court acquitted two U.S. soldiers in the death of a pair of 14-year-old South Koreans. In June, the girls were crushed by a 50-ton military vehicle as they were walking to a birthday party. Yesterday, dozens of activists broke into a U.S. military base north of Seoul and chained themselves together. On Monday, students firebombed a U.S. military warehouse in Seoul. South Korea hosts 37,000 U.S. troops under a mutual defense pact dating back to the 1950-53 Korean War. The Bush administration has asked a federal claims court to seal documents relating to hundreds of claims that a mercury-based preservative in vaccines, thimerosal, has caused autism and other neurological disorders in children. Lawyers for the families seeking government compensation are outraged. The move comes on the heels of a related controversy. The new Homeland Security Act contains a provision intended to shield pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly from lawsuits over the preservative. The provision would force families to seek compensation through the government's vaccine court instead of civil courts. Eli Lilly is the pharmaceutical industry's biggest backer of the Republican Party. White House Budget Director Mitch Daniels is a former Eli Lilly corporate executive. And last June, President Bush appointed Eli Lilly's chair, President and CEO Sidney Taurel, to a seat on the president's Homeland Security Advisory Council. There's a new development in the case of the British UN worker Ian Hook, who was shot dead Friday in Jenin by Israeli troops. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees is reporting an Israeli soldier shot Hook in the back at a time of no military activity in that area. And there's a meanwhile, an Israeli warplane has bombed a building in the Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians. The military claims they were local leaders of Hamas and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Israeli troops arrested dozens of Palestinian men and their relatives in Ramallah, Jenin, Nablus, and Hebron. And Israeli forces raided the central Gaza Strip with tanks, helicopters, and bulldozers.
And ever since we came to this land, this country has ruled the day. When we would stand as one and raise our voices and say, you know, sons and your daughters won't die in the hourglass.
Gil Scott-Heron, a toast to the people here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 1.5 billion people across the globe watch the Miss World beauty pageant every year. Women from over 100 countries compete for the crown. The Miss World website brags Miss World 2002 will be the most lavish and spectacular production we've ever undertaken. It's second only to the Olympics for international participation. The pageant was scheduled to be held in Nigeria, but Muslim Christian riots erupted. Some 220 people are dead, and a Nigerian state governor has called for the death of a journalist. It started when Muslims in Nigeria began protesting the pageant. Then a journalist by the name of Isyama Daniel wrote an article in the Lagos-based paper This Day in which she speculated that the Prophet Muhammad would not only have approved of the Miss World beauty pageant, but might have wanted to marry one of the contestants. Muslim Christian riots erupted. 220 people are dead, 1,000 injured, 8,000 are homeless, and mosques and churches have been razed to the ground. Yesterday, the government of the mainly Muslim state in northern Nigeria urged believers to kill the journalist. He said, like Salman Rushdie, the blood of Isiama Daniel can be shed. The Miss World organization is insisting it had nothing to do with the riots in Nigeria. Despite the 3 days of violence, the 89 contestants with the chair of the Miss World competition, Julia Morley, denied responsibility and refused to accept that the decision to hold the contest in Nigeria had been a mistake. To complicate the story, before any of this began, some pageant contestants threatened to boycott the pageant over the case of Amina Lawal. Earlier this year, an Islamic court in northern Nigeria sentenced Lawal to be stoned to death for having a baby out of wedlock. An article in the London Telegraph from yesterday goes something like this. Beauty pageants have a hard time these days rising above farce, rising above tragedy is harder, and rising above the threat of war fought out by Muslims versus the rest of the world is hardest of all. We're joined right now by Fawzia Afzal Khan. She is a professor here in the United States in Montclair. She's a professor of English at Montclair State University. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
What is your response to what has taken place and the whole framing of this issue?
Well, you know, to sort of take up with the earlier case, Amina Lawal, one of the listservs, many listservs that I'm on, somebody had written on it, a woman, asking for some help from other members on the listserv when the case first broke, what her response as a Muslim woman, as a feminist Muslim from within Islam should be. And I, you know, remember thinking, I can't believe that this question could even be posed in these terms, but it made me think of the way in which the framing, as you call it, has gotten constructed of late, in which Muslim women, particularly from within the Muslim societies, the Muslim world, who identify with Islam, feel somehow that they have to defend every terrible, crazy action that really fanatic, extreme sort of people from within the Islamic world think up or cook up as a way to sort of project Islamic morals or values on the rest of the world or an Islamic framework. And so this woman, I actually wrote back immediately saying, I don't even think that that is a question that needs to be asked. As a human being, what they're trying to do to Amina Lawal is simply, unacceptable. And it should be clear to anybody with any kind of faith that no religion would condone stoning a woman, because she's being accused of something that it would be very hard to prove in the absence, even from within the Islamic world, in the absence of four adult male witnesses to the act of sexual penetration. So, I think the framing is dangerous, and I think the same thing is being played out right now with this beauty contest.
We're also joined on the telephone by Aziza Al-Hibri, who is a law professor at the University of Richmond in Virginia, who's been following the case of Amina Lawal closely. Before we go forward and talk more about the Miss World contest, can you tell us about the origins of this?
Well, I should say that the question of what, as a Muslim, should I be thinking or saying is a legitimate question. And in fact, I have been asked that question by many women. We had a telephone conference, and I explained to them what they needed to know was what is really Islamic law, and what does Islamic law say about the case. The reason for the question is that many Muslims do not know the details of their religion, especially when it has to do with an application of this sort. The question is not about how can I defend every horrible thing in the Muslim world, but what does Islam really say about this? And the fact of the matter is that Islam doesn't say about this what either the court has decided or what the papers have written about. That's the sad thing about this whole matter, that the actual people in Northern Virginia in the court who said they were applying the law to Amina Lawal, in fact, did not apply the law on the books in their own jurisdiction, and instead applied something else. a lot of politics has gone on into this case, a lot of classism, etc., but not Islam. And to hear that Islam, you know, as was a little bit in the introduction mentioned, is now threatening violence or war against the rest of the world, that Islam is not a reasonable religion, this is really very silly. It really explains why Muslims feel put upon and in a defensive position, because their real issues have not been interpreted to the world properly. They are the ones under attack.
Giving a little background on the Amina Lawal case, in October 2001, first there was Safiya Husseini, who was condemned to death, a 35-year-old, by stoning for allegedly committing adultery. Mm-hmm. Amnesty International helped save her life. She was acquitted on technical grounds by an appeals court. And then what happened with Amina Lawal, 30 years old?
Well, again, Amina Lawal was accused of having committed adultery out of wedlock. Therefore, she was sentenced to be stoned to death. First of all, we note that in both cases, we're talking about women who are helpless and who are from the poorest strata of society. We never hear either about richer women meeting that fate or the men who were involved in either case to have been penalized. In Islam, whatever is the punishment for adultery, it's equal vis-a-vis the male and the female. But the other point that is really interesting about Amina Lawal is that her case should have never been even in court. It should have never reached court by the law of Nigeria itself. Because Nigeria is a Maliki jurisdiction in the north, if I'm talking about the Muslim communities. And under the Maliki jurisdiction, since Amina Lawal was married 2 years before her pregnancy, then automatically under the Maliki jurisprudence, the theory of the sleeping fetus kicks in, which says that the child would be attributed to the father up to a period of 5 to 7 years, depending on the jurisdiction in which the Maliki law is applied. She is within 2 years of that. So automatically the child should have been assumed to be that of the father, and therefore she should have never been hauled into court. Now, the claim is that, yeah, even if that's true, she confessed. But the fact of the matter is that she didn't confess till she got to court. And furthermore, it is an element of Maliki jurisprudence and other Islamic law that if somebody confesses, first you have to make sure that the confession is free and informed. She had neither. Secondly, the minute a person in this position retracts their confession, you stop. She retracted her confession, and the Court of Appeals refused to accept it. That is against their law again. So there are a lot of other elements that one could go through about Amina Lawal that makes no sense under Nigerian law itself as applied Islamic law in northern Nigeria, which is Maliki.
And how this is a backdrop for the world, Miss World pageant?
Well, you tell me. I understand that there has been a some comment about the women in the world wanting to stand by Lawal and not knowing how. And so they decided, how could we go and have an activity in Nigeria when women are oppressed there? Well, frankly, I think having a pageant is even doubly oppressive of women. It's not really something that feminists necessarily look positively at.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We will also be joined by Gloria Allred, a feminist attorney and founder and president of the Women's Equal Rights Legal Defense and Education Fund. Our guest on the line with us, joining us from the University of Richmond, is Aziza Al-Hibri, law professor there, and in the studio, Fawzia Afzal Khan. We will also be joined by Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, who is a professor of history at Cornell and wrote the book The Body Project. That's all coming up. Stay with us.
Out by a shanty where the dust hangs high, far from a river where things grow. grow green. The flowers weep and they lean away from the blood-stained soil beneath my feet. The thorns outnumber the petals on the rose, and the darkness amplifies the sound of printer's ink on propaganda page.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report, and we're looking at, well, an event that maybe a lot of viewers did not watch or did, but the fact is that more than a billion viewers around the globe watch the Miss World contest. According to the London Telegraph, it's the biggest annual outside broadcast on the planet. We're joined on the line by Gloria Allred, a feminist attorney with the Women's Equal Rights Legal Defense and Education Fund. She founded it and is president. Your response to what has taken place in northern Nigeria with the deaths of more than 200 people at this point. Now, apparently, the Miss World contest being moved from Nigeria and the contestants showing up in London.
Well, Amy, last month I held a news conference with my client, who is a former Miss USA in the Miss Universe system, Brandi Sherwood. And we pointed out that the Miss World Beauty Pageant was scheduled to hold its annual pageant in Nigeria, and it would be broadcast to 10 billion viewers worldwide. It would be the largest entertainment event ever held in that country. And we were there to protest the decision of that pageant to hold its contest there, where such a barbaric sentence had been imposed on Amina Lawal, and which the sentence, of course, being that she would be sentenced to death by stoning because she gave birth to a child outside of marriage, and that sentence had been appealed to a higher court and was affirmed. And we felt that the pageant should not hold its contest in that country where such a barbaric sentence had been imposed, and we urged the pageant to move to another location unless the sentence was revised or nullified by a Nigerian court. We felt that no woman should be punished at all for having a baby outside of marriage, and that it was unconscionable and a violation of a woman's human rights to impose a sentence of being stoned to death simply because the woman had become a mother. I mean, motherhood, whether it is inside or outside of marriage, is not a crime, nor should it be, and the imposition of such a sentence is shocking to the conscience. And although the Miss World pageant had announced that it would make a statement as part of the broadcast condemning what they called such inhumane action, it was going to go ahead with the contest, and it was going to allow contestants the opportunity to bring petitions from their countries, which the pageant said it would present to the Nigerian government. And that, we felt, was not enough, because we felt that when a mother's life is at stake, that it's grossly insufficient and unacceptable to simply weave such a statement into an entertainment event. And we felt that mere lip service alone was not going to suffice. And the only way to demonstrate how outrageous and unacceptable such a draconian death sentence is would be to completely withdraw the pageant from Nigeria unless the conviction and the sentence were reversed by a Nigerian court. And that didn't happen, and instead 100 lives have been taken. And that would never have happened if they had moved that contest out of the country as we had recommended.
I would like to just jump in there for a second.
Fawzia Afzal Khan, professor of English at Montclair State.
Thanks. Which is to ask, I mean, a question that we're not asking in this whole debate is why, you know, why was Nigeria selected in the first place? What did that selection allow people to do, including the feminist groups, that your guest just talked about, who want to oppose it, oppose the Miss World pageant for holding its function there because, you know, of this barbaric thing that happened regarding Amina Lawal, or on the other hand, women who want to defend it, women who would participate in the Miss World pageant saying,
well,
oh, no.
I can answer that question. I think the reason I think it was chosen was because last year's winner was Miss Nigeria. But that's not enough. And look, we were interested in protecting Ms. Laval. That's what we were interested in.
Yes,
that's
but what's interesting...
to the Miss World pageant, asking them to reconsider their decision not to withdraw from the pageant. And we also felt that Miss World USA delegate to the pageant, whose name, by the way, was not even permitted to be revealed until very much, until recently, we didn't want her to participate either. And there were many contestants from other countries like who chose not to participate because of the draconian sentence handed down from Ms. Loire. Contestants from Switzerland, from France, Belgium, Denmark, Norway.
Yes, but don't you see what this kind of debate allows you to do? It allows you to take a position which, what I was arguing earlier, then makes women from within the Muslim world feel like they either have to say no to, you know, Western so-called progressive feminists from coming in and, you know, bringing attention to draconian laws that somehow have only, you know, that only get passed in these regressive Muslim societies, which is, you know, not the case. I mean, that is not a position I, for example, as a feminist who identifies herself, you know, from being within the Muslim world, wants to be in a position to have to defend. What I'm saying is we have to look at the global context within which these discourses get started and these debates get sort of focused. And I think that this is something that is being blown out of all proportion.
Well,
and it was a very unwise choice to begin with. We should be looking at where the world is headed and what Nigeria's real problems are, okay, which are,
okay,
you know, economic poverty and illiteracy and all sorts of other things that get shoved under the carpet because suddenly our focus is on these women prancing about in a Miss World contest, and somehow that's become our, you know, barometer for liberation. This
Amy,
is crazy.
Amy, I don't understand why it's so difficult for any woman or any man to condemn what is a gross violation of international law, that a woman should be stoned to death.
It should absolutely be condemned.
I don't know why that presents any kind of moral dilemma for anyone. I think that should be an easy thing to condemn.
Yes, as long as you are also condemning what the U.S. is doing continuously by imposing its military and economic might on these countries.
Well,
you know, let's do that in the same breath that we talk about draconian punishment. There are reasons why these things are happening now in parts of the Muslim world that are a reaction to world events. And that's been happening for the last several decades.
Well,
for example, Muslim country like Pakistan, when I grew up, didn't have any of these punishments. A lot of this stuff happened when General Ziaul Haq was put in power, frankly, by the United States. I mean, there are larger debates here that are getting hidden because we're focusing on, you know, the silliness, I'm sorry, of Miss World pageants.
Well, can I say something, please? First of all, I think if we're going to go anywhere with this discussion, we need to discuss it with cooler heads and to leave space in our voices for others to speak. I do not want to hear, for example, the righteous Western voice condemning what is happening in Nigeria. I'd rather leave room for the Muslim voice to do the same. I would like to say that if we want to solve...
want to say this is Aziza Al-Hibri, law professor at University of Richmond.
If we want to solve the problems in Nigeria or elsewhere, we need to understand what is it that we have at heart. Is what we have at heart saving Amina Lawal and other women and improving the legal system in these countries, or is it to try and shame these countries and claim that Islam is barbaric or imposes barbaric punishment? I think that the Western feminists overseas have done a great disservice to Muslim women. I know that because I have been trying to work in many of these countries and trying to change the laws in the interest of women. But whenever the Western feminists who do not understand the nature of the country come in and make accusations against Islam as a whole and make this look like an East-West clash or Muslims versus the world, then it becomes very hard to have a peaceful moment to argue in a reasonable way with these people to change the law. I think the only and the best solution for Amina Lawal is for people like my organization to prepare a delegation of Muslim leaders, women, along with men, and to go to Nigeria and sit with the court and ask the court to justify their decision on Islamic basis. We have never had this kind of rational discussion, and we've been calling for it because we think the court can absolutely not justify its position on religious issues. And when that becomes clear, it will either have to retract or the people will realize that this is not Islam but tribalism and politics in Nigeria, because there are a lot of political sensitive situations there. there. What we ask from the Western women is to support us. I'm a Western Muslim, but I ask for the Western non-Muslim or secularist to support us in our effort, because what we need to do in the ultimate, in the final analysis, is to help the women, not to get on the pages of newspapers and not to create a big story.
Gloria Allred.
Yeah, Amy, yeah, in conclusion, what I'd like to say is I really cannot even understand why any woman, whether she is a Muslim woman or anybody else, would be so defensive about this. As
we're
I have pointed out.
Don't finish.
You've got two Muslim women there, and you have just me, and I just have a concluding remark here, and I'd like to be able to say it and not be filibustered. I'd appreciate that courtesy, ma'am. Look, this is about a violation of human rights, international law. No one should defend this. It isn't about Christians who've been killed in Nigeria in the recent riots over this, and it isn't about Muslims who've been killed in the recent riots. It's about the fact that no woman should be stoned to death for having a baby outside of marriage.
By Gloria Allred, what about
the man?
What about Aziza Alhibri's response that she also, just to answer her point, that she also condemns this, mm-hmm. but she feels in terms of strategy to be most effective, that it would be helpful for example, American Muslim groups, rather American feminist groups, to support Muslim feminist groups and being at the fore on this.
Okay, well, the point is that everybody should condemn it. Everybody should have done whatever they could. We did. We spoke out. We said the pageant should be moved. And that was a month before 100 people were killed in these riots. If they had moved it, instead of worrying about profits or whatever other reason that they kept it there, this would not have happened. But the point is, everybody needs to get on board, and everybody shouldn't, you know, try to load this up like balls on a Christmas tree with 100 other different issues that Muslims are upset about or Christians are upset about or anybody else is. The point is,
for
someone's
my
life
conclusory
is still at stake,
remark.
And she could be killed by stoning, and we all have to get behind saving her life.
Let me bring Joan Jacobs-Brumberg into the conversation, professor of a history and women's studies at Cornell University. Can you weigh in here your response to the beauty pageant in Nigeria?
Well, I think it's more than silliness. I think that the size of the audience for the Miss World pageant is a really a stunning indication of the power of the ideal of Western beauty, which is an increasingly monolithic ideal of female beauty, and it's associated with the spread of American economic influence and popular culture. The size of that audience actually floors me. 10 million viewers worldwide. It really means that women as well as men are watching. It means that women are contributing to their own objectification. It's not just men who are doing it to us. I think that's why we read so many stories about, particularly, there are stories primarily, I think, about Saudi Arabia, but I may be wrong, about bikinis beneath burqas. I think what we're really dealing with in Miss World, what we need to think about is the public health effects of Miss World.
Thank you, a very good point. I'm just going to say I have to go, and I thank you so much for this very important conversation that you're having. Thank you very much.
That's Gloria Allred.
Goodbye.
Bye. From Los Angeles.
Those are your remarks, because I have to go as well, as you know.
Hello? Yes. Yes, okay.
Yeah, I would like to say that the last speaker was exactly on point. As an American feminist, I'm really bewildered about the attitude on these pageants that we have seen recently. I do not think that it is in any way a decent response to what's happening to Amina Lawal to say that we're not going to hold the pageant there. They should not have the pageant there anyway because of the way it objectifies women and further contributes to the oppression of women, whether in Nigeria or the rest of the world. But the one thing I want to point out is that Muslim women have condemned what is happening, have criticized it from the inside and not only from the outside. And I think the inside critique is more important than the outside because the people listen to it. And yet our feminist sisters are not not listening to us. And when they talk about this issue, they say they want us to condemn it. It doesn't matter, it seems, how much we condemn it. They don't hear us. And what I ask is that now the feminist Muslims be heard, because this is our turn to clean up our own house, and we don't need help from the outside.
Aziz Al-Hibri, I just want to ask you a quick question, and that is a response to something that Fawzia Afzal Khan said at the beginning, which is that we should look at the intensification of, for example, these punishments also in a bigger political context, like the U.S. support of the Pakistani dictator Zia-ul-Haq. You have talked openly about your involvement with the State Department, them sending you off to Afghanistan and Pakistan as under the Office of Public Diplomacy. What is your response to that?
Before 9/11, and I went to 13 Muslim countries to discuss two things: democracy and family law. And in fact, I've also consulted in one country about their family law, and advise some others in another country in the process of developing family law about their issues. I think it's an important service for American Muslim feminists to give to the Muslim world if they ask for it. And what I would have very much liked in Afghanistan, but was not able to do at that time before 9/11, is again to form a delegation. And we talked about that, to go to the Taliban, about whom I have written and criticized publicly before 9/11, and their fall, and sit with them on a religious basis, discuss one for one every point they have passed which is oppressive to women. Because I do know, and I have written, that Islam gives women all the rights that we are calling for, but that what we are seeing around is a corruption of Islam. And what Fawzia is talking about is that many of the regimes that came and corrupted the interpretation of Islam or its application due to tribal and other reasons have had the support of the United States government because of geopolitical considerations. And then when they mess up, it is not the our government that gets blamed for that. It's the Muslims who have to take the brunt of this. And frankly, Muslims are fed up of this. That's why they seem to be on the defensive. But what they need is to be able to determine in a very democratic fashion their own governments, their own way of being, their own rulers or governors, and their own interpretation of Islam, instead of having certain people imposed on them. Remember that bin Laden, for a long time, originally when he was fighting the Soviets, he was receiving training and support from the United States. And now the Muslim world has to to answer for him. And the same thing with many other people. So you can imagine the frustration of the Muslim world.
I'd like to have a couple of concluding things to say, actually one main point, Amy, which is that, thanks very much for having me on today. And while I sort of agree with almost everything that Aziza has said and respect her opinion as somebody, who really practices and knows a great deal about Muslim jurisprudence and so on, my own feeling about, I agree with her that I think from within the Muslim world, societies have to decide democratically which way they want to go. But I think within that, we have to remember that there are many, many forces within the Muslim world who really want and have always believed in a separation of church and state. They want to develop secular laws. Pakistan, in fact, had a secular constitution up until the late Zia-ul-Haq, who imposed this Sharia, his version of the Sharia law, on the people of Pakistan. And Muslim feminists there, and I know this is true of many other Muslim countries as well, have many, many Muslim feminists really believe that the way to go is not to try to fight the mullah version of Islam by coming up with, something necessarily called a feminist Islamic version, but rather to insist that the idea of Islam as a religion should be something that people believe and practice in their homes, but it should not be something that should really lead to a debate on the legal level, because that way lies too many difficulties. And I think we should really have that debate within the Muslim world as well, which is, those are the voices that are being squashed.
And of course, Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, the Miss Universe contest also, or the Miss World contest, goes well beyond the issue of the a debate within the Muslim world. This is overall a Western institution.
Well, it's a Western institution that's being imported, you know, like McDonald's hamburgers all over the world, principally through the vehicle of American popular culture, you know, TV and films. And there's a lot of very good anthropological evidence now and sociological evidence that there are psychological consequences for women and girls wherever this westernized ideal of beauty becomes the model or the template for women and girls. I mean, it's not something that builds confidence in women and girls. Instead, it creates, you know, this kind of classic body angst or bad body fever, this sense that, you know, that there's something wrong with my body. Eating disorders spread. We know that from, you know, looking at where anorexia nervosa and bulimia are spreading around the world in these, you know, primarily in the beginning in affluent pockets and communities in Asia and in Latin America. But, you know, this phenomenon of the bikini beneath the burqa fascinates me because it suggests that even when women believe and live in a culture that takes a more traditional role, a view of women's bodies, this Western ideal is very powerful, very seductive, and it does seem to have public health consequences in terms of the psychology of women and their actual health. And the irony is that this ideal or this template appeals even in cultures where there isn't enormous affluence and where there is poverty.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much all for joining us in this multi-tiered conversation. Joan Jacobs-Brumberg is the author of The Body Project and Fasting Girls. She teaches at Cornell University. Aziza Hibri, law professor at University of Richmond in Virginia. And Fawzia Afzal Khan, a professor of English at Montclair State University. When we come back, we're going to turn to an Iraqi nuclear scientist who was with the Iraqi nuclear program for 30 years. Stay with us.
Come. I say come. You sitting still in domestic bacteria. Come. I say come. You standing still in double-breasted mornings. Come. I say come and return to the fight. This fight for the earth. This fight for our children. This fight for our life. We need your hurricane voices. We need your sacred hands. I say come, sister, brother, to the battlefield. Come into the rainforest. Come into the hood. Come into the barrio. Come into the schools. Come into the abortion clinics. Come into the prisons. Come and caress our spines. I say come, wrap your feet around justice. I say come, wrap your tongues around truth. I say come
to the battlefield here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Earlier today, United Nations weapons inspectors completed their first field visit in Iraq in 4 years. One group of inspectors drove to a large military compound in an eastern suburb of Baghdad to search for missiles, chemical and biological weapons. A second group, a team from the International Atomic Energy Agency, went to a small industrial complex northeast of Baghdad to investigate Iraq's nuclear facilities. Up to 200 inspectors are expected to soon spread out over Iraq in search of mobile laboratories, underground factories, and other signs of banned Iraqi weapons production. Under the terms of the resolution, Baghdad has until December 8th to produce a list of any nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons in its arsenal, the accuracy of which weapons inspectors will be asked to verify. We're going to turn right now to Imad Khaduri. He is a former Iraqi nuclear scientist who worked for 30 years at Iraq's Atomic Energy Commission. He left Iraq in 1998. I asked him to talk about his experience in the Iraqi nuclear program and why he doesn't believe President Bush's reports that Iraq's nuclear capability, its ability to create a nuclear bomb, is imminent.
After the war ended, the whole staff of the nuclear power program was directed toward the rehabilitation of the oil and the electricity sectors. And after a couple of years, they were completely dismembered, disbanded into separate units doing civilian work or joining other other institutions. There was no more leadership. There was no more management. There was no more resources, no more facilities. There's no way one can blow in a balloon full of holes. What I mean by that is if you don't have the resources, the manpower, you cannot have such a huge, complex enterprise going on. And the fate of the Iraqi scientists and engineers who worked in that program economically these days is very dismal, as the whole middle class in Iraq. There is no incentive, there is no gathering force for them to make any new reinvention of that program, as claimed by the two great powers that seem to want war on Iraq.
Can you go back to 1991 and what was happening in the nuclear program as the U.S. was bombing Iraq, and then what happened afterwards?
At first, apparently, after the war ended, we realized that the Americans who were bombing, doing the most of the bombing, didn't realize the significance of many of our establishments. Only after the war ended and the inspectors came did they find out that there were some buildings which they have missed, and that the building that they did hit, by chance, in a sense, was a very important link in the whole program. So that told us that these intelligence agencies either were so devoid of real knowledge of a program that has been going on for 10 years and with 7,000 staff participants, or now they are doing the same thing again. They are feeding the wrong information to their leadership that there is a program when there isn't. It's just so contradictory.
Where were you at the time?
I was assigned to I was reallocated to a safe location for the families of the top nuclear scientists near a site that was bombed in the last few days by the Americans when they realized it looked like a site that there was some activity and concern when it was bombed. So I was in that site, and that housing complex was also bombed, and my family escaped, luckily. And then we went back to Baghdad to do the reconstruction.
We're talking to Imad Khaduri, who was involved with Iraq's nuclear program for 30 years. So after 1991, can you describe the level of Iraq's nuclear program and then what happened over the next years and what happened when the weapons inspectors came in?
It was simply a mopping up operation of whatever was going on, taking care of the staff, dispersing them, assigning them to the rehabilitation of the oil refineries that were bombed, the electric power stations that were destroyed. And then many of them went back to universities. They just sort of drifted loosely. There was no more work on any nuclear, in a sense, or in this grave sense that is now portrayed after 1990. There was simply no more resources, no more management to carry on this great complex of enterprise.
Can you talk about what happened in 1994 when a report surfaced claiming that Iraq was still manufacturing a nuclear bomb?
Yes, apparently the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, was very interested in that, and they rushed to Baghdad trying to verify this report. And as soon as we took a good look at it, it was quite apparent that some of the words used in the reports are not used by Arabic-speaking people, but by Iranians. And we bought a dictionary to verify what we are saying. For example, a semi-dome is called differently in Arabic and in Iranian. And we pointed that out, and the IA experts were convinced, and they never brought up the matter again. It's part of the propaganda against Iraq that we were still carrying on any sort of nuclear weapon program, which is false.
Mm-hmm. What about how the Iraqi nuclear program developed in the first place, going back to the 1950s?
Well, it is strange enough that the Iraqi nuclear program started with an American aid of a complete library under the Eisenhower's Atom for Peace program. That arrived in Iraq in 1956. Some of the information and the reports there actually contain the Manhattan Project reports that Americans built the atomic bomb upon. And that finally it was with us, and we could look at it in the end, and we made some use of it.
Are you saying you had classified U.S. Manhattan Project documents?
The complete set of reports that were published, yes.
From who?
United States.
But who gave them to Iraq?
Eisenhower.
He gave the classified documents.
Well, at the time, it was the action against the Soviet entrance into the nuclear club, and there was this Atom for Peace program. And the Americans' position at the time was, if you spread this news, you will lessen the knowledge of, you are being frank about what you're doing. And the reports, in any case, were from the Manhattan Project, were at that time considered part of the scientific literature. Only later did the Americans clamp down on this information.
And in the Atoms for Peace program, was that for atomic energy for peaceful purposes or with the very clear intent of developing the atomic bomb?
No, it was for peaceful purposes. But that set of Manhattan projects was part of it somehow.
Uh-huh. We're talking to Dr. Imad Khaduri, involved with Iraq's nuclear program for 30 years. Can you talk about UN Weapons Inspector David Kaye and what he discovered and when he discovered it?
Yes, this person had some information on the location of our set of documents, complete set of documents, which are the result of our scientific research that was being done. Sorry. And he raided the building that the documents were in the morning of one day. And from that, they gleaned the information that there were much more to the atomic weaponization program than they originally thought. And that led to further discoveries on that line. But all the while, they were digging into the ruins of the program. Nothing that was going on anymore, any continuation of the program, just the skeleton or the remains of what was.
They were being housed in a welded train car that was traveling up and down Iraq?
That was the initial intent of hiding them, but when the inspectors came and they were starting asking scientific questions from our staff, our nuclear scientists, and the scientists had to have the information and the reports so they can give them to the inspectors, they requested that these reports be handed back to them so that they can refer to them when to ask their questions. We were open about it. So they had, then the order was given to stop that train, get the documents back, and to let the scientists and engineers look at them. And that's how somehow Kaye got the information and timely ambushed them.
Hussein Kamil, the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, was in charge of the military-industrial authority that was in charge of the nuclear weapons program?
Yes, he took charge of the program in 1987. And for the 3 years following until the war, the program accelerated immensely in its activities. And he was in charge until he left.
And he went to Jordan?
Yes, in 1995.
And there he talked about his documents being buried in his farm?
Yes, he did, actually. And there were apparently documents not related to the nuclear, as I mentioned. There's other information, maybe one or two documents, but the majority of the documents about the nuclear was the cache that David Kaye found in that building.
Mm-hmm. Then he was, Hussein Kamil was killed when he went back to Iraq? Saddam Hussein had him killed?
Well, apparently he was given a chance to come back, and it didn't work out that way.
Uh-huh. So now we have the latest reports with people like Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, talking about the aluminum rods that were found having been sent to Iraq, and these could be used or were proof of the nuclear weapons program. Can you talk about that, how they could be used and what they meant to you?
there are so many components in such a complex enterprise that any of these elements, as these materials, can be misguidedly pointed out as being useful. Even today in the morning, there were some carbon graphite rods used in batteries. Well, it was said they could be used in missiles or whatever. I mean, it's so easy to make claims of the sort. But let Condoleezza Rice talk about who is going to use these. There's nobody there to use this. You cannot beat a dead horse to get up again. And this is all part of the misinformation that's being spread around.
I'm looking at a piece now about President Bush's remarks on the Iraqi threat. Many people have asked how close Saddam Hussein is to developing a nuclear weapon. Bush said, he says, we don't exactly know, and that's the problem. Before the Gulf War, the best intelligence indicated Iraq was 8 to 10 years away from developing a nuclear weapon. After the war, international inspectors learned the regime has been much closer. He went on to say that the evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program. Saddam Hussein has held numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists, a group he calls his nuclear mujahideen, his nuclear holy warriors. Satellite photographs reveal Iraq is rebuilding facilities at sites that have been part of its nuclear program in the past. Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. These President Bush's recent comments in Cincinnati, Ohio.
These are very flimsy indications that are being put forward. Let them just ask the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IEA. They put a report in 1998 stating quite evidently that there is no such program. In 2-3 years, such a huge enterprise cannot be resurrected. And the IEA is there now today. They can look again. And any of this can be easily disclaimed by just asking the IAEA. You don't have to ask me or anybody else. Just ask the International Atomic Energy Commission. They will confirm that such a program on such a scale is just impossible to carry through. And all this that's being put forward by whoever you mentioned on his reports from his intelligence is either intentionally false or is evidently not true.
Well, these are Bush's own statements. He said, if the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
This is not like a bullet. You have to have a gun. You cannot deliver, even if you have this little ball in your hand, how can you deliver it? With what means? With what rockets? With what guidance system? With what control systems? The whole infrastructure is not there.
Imad Kaduri, former nuclear scientists in Iraq for the last 30 years, left Iraq in 1998, now teaches at Seneca College in Canada. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! On Thanksgiving, we will bring you a speech by historian Howard Zinn. And on Friday, you'll hear a debate between my colleague Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, president of National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and William McGowan, author of Coloring the News, How Crusading for Diversity Has Corrupted American Journalism. It was a debate they had a week ago at the National Press Club. That does it for today's program. Our website is www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica's Democracy Now!